The man to my left is, as you've probably guessed, the cartoonist David Boswell, the creator of Reed Fleming. The creator of the Reed Fleming series, one of the great independent comic series of the 1980s and 1990s, and the creator of Heartbreak Comics, one of the best single issue comics, I think, ever. Certainly in post-1970, yeah, anything. It's a terrific comic. And my name's Tom. I'll be asking some questions. Hopefully we can get the AV working and see some of David's art. It's kind of been a curious situation in that one of the reasons David's in town this weekend is being honored and being put in the Giants of North Hall of Fame, the Canadian Cartooning Hall of Fame, which is a terrific honor and well-deserved. And Seth, the cartoonist, will be interviewing him tonight. So Seth and I kind of talked on the phone and or kind of talked via email and decided, you know, what Seth would be covering and what Seth wouldn't. And so I get everything that's left. So I'm not a... If it sounds like I'm just jumping around, that's because I am. I'm kind of jumping around Seth's planned interview. You know, the one thing I wanted to ask you, or the first thing I wanted to ask you, is that part of your bio is that when you graduated film school, it simply says you decided to become a cartoonist. You decided to try to make money drawing comics. And this seems kind of sensible. It might seem more sensible now, but especially in 1974, that sounds to me like an incredibly not odd thing or kind of unique thing to want to do, because that's not exactly, it wasn't exactly a rich time for comics. Can you talk about how you made that decision? I mean, what was going on that made you kind of pushed you into comics?
Well, it was not, hey, look, progress.
We're almost there.
Funny pictures coming up.
Well, it was not a direct line from college to comics. There were a couple of years in between. And before I became a cartoonist, I became a pizza driver. Hey, that's where we're getting there. So,
I hope you have nothing embarrassing on your hard drive, dude.
Well, can you make like a slideshow just out of that folder?
These are just random images, covers, and other pictures of Reed Fleming, just to keep you amused. There we go. When he says that, he's not talking to you. He's talking to you. Anyway, I didn't think of comics initially at all. I was in filmmaking. There we go. If I can just fill the screen. Yeah. Some of these you will have seen before. Others should be new. It's not my computer, so that's my excuse.
Ah. There we go. Thank you, girl. Thank you, people I don't know.
As I was saying, I was in film school at Sheridan College in Oakville. We all know where that is. And at the conclusion of my studies, and I should say I did not graduate, I got an I for incomplete. My film was not done in time. So the film was all right, but it was quickly evident that there was no real future in filmmaking at that time. The only career advice we were given in 1974 was to go to the CBC and apply for a job as an assistant truck driver. Two of my buddies did that, and they were number 123 and 124 on the waiting list. So I thought, you know, and that's how you're going to start and maybe make a film in 30 years. So this is a pair, it's going too fast to talk about, but anyway, enjoy the amusing pictures. Can we get rid of that stuff in the blue room eventually? Anyhow, so there I was out of film school with a film that I tried to get shown on the CBC, a live-action film, not animated. I never thought about drawing as a career until I was forced to. So I did odd jobs for a couple of years after finishing college, and one of those jobs was as a pizza driver. And you can't disdain that kind of experience because, in a strange way, it allowed me to become, you know, the chronicler of this guy who delivered a different product. There, famous cut line.
Part of the creation of Reed, or part of the story of his creation, is that he showed up in your sketchbook and maybe kept showing up in your sketches before. I mean, there's a year between where it says you invented him and when he actually saw publication in the weekly comics you were doing at the time.
Well, I'll just continue the chronology.
Okay.
This job as a pizza driver, you know, not a great job, obviously, but I kept all my tips.
And after about 6 months, I had enough to buy a drafting table, a really good solid drafting table, which I still use today, solid wood, 6 feet long. And my point is you need to have a good space to work, and preferably a tabletop. So there was a benefit there in terms of what I got, and the experience of going door to door and, you know, seeing into people's lives and interacting, you know, is obviously what Reed Fleming does. So that led to poverty. Anyway, I had the drafting table. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but it was a good place to work. And I wound up in Toronto here working at a photography studio on Church Street. I was the darkroom technician, not to be confused with gigolo. And I made all the prints, and they were really tedious because they were all mostly photographs of car tires. We had the Canadian Tire account back then, and every photograph of a tire had to be made in three prints, a light one, a dark one, and a medium one, so the people who put the catalogs together would have a choice. So working, you know, again, car tires endlessly all day long got kind of tedious. But it wasn't a bad job for the winter, but the real impetus to leave that job and find something else was the change in climate. And when the spring started happening in 1977, I couldn't bear being inside the dark, you know, all day long. So I had always kept a sketchbook, but I never thought about comics. You know, it wasn't my first interest. But I had a friend who thought I did funny work. Her name was Cynthia. And she began to take my work to show her colleagues, and she'd report back and say, "Your drawings went over gangbusters. People liked what you were doing." And I was getting feedback. Made me think maybe I could do something with comics. And the golden moment was hearing that the New Yorker paid $600 for a single panel cartoon. My rent was then $45 a week. So I started thinking, you know, a couple of cartoons a year, I'm laughing. What I didn't know was how hard it was to break in. So I began to send up packages of single panel cartoons to publications like Playboy, Esquire, National Lampoon, and before long I had a nice collection of rejection slips. But I was starting to get comments written on the rejection slips by people. They were paying attention. I didn't know then, but found out that nobody buys first time from anybody. They want to see you can turn out work consistently and, you know, repeatably. You're not just a one-shot wonder. So they'll never buy first time. What you do is you send them 12 cartoons, they send them back, you send them 12 more right away. So I was doing that. And the cartoons I was sending out then were more enigmatic, maybe even funny. But that wasn't the point. The point is that I sent a single page comic out, along with the single panels, about Laszlo, the great Slavic lover. It's right. Called Heartbreak Comics. And that got a bit of a response, but it wasn't until I was told to send comics to the Georgia Strait.
Sure.
That's a Vancouver underground newspaper. It's not underground now, but back then it was, you know, still kind of underground. And to my surprise, that full page strip, which I have someplace here I can show you, and I should just start working the computer myself, that was bought by the Strait. But the guy who purchased it misled me as to his actual job responsibilities. He was the advertising manager, not the editor, not the publisher. And he was also Slavic, and so he responded to the character. Laszlo's actually Hungarian, not Slavic, but great Slavic lover sounds better than great Hungarian lover. Anyway, he said, "Send more." And I thought, great, I got a weekly gig. And the fact that they were paying $20 for a whole page was secondary to the fact that I was getting published. So I thought, great, I'm a cartoonist now, and started, you know, what do I do next? I got one page, how do I do another? And that's the hard part, is how do you generate new material? And after a while, well, that's in the future, but I had that one comic to my credit and a weekly gig, and I was still living here in Toronto over on Howland Avenue. Initially, I had a rooming house, which is just like two blocks from here on Collier Street, but couldn't work there, just a room and a lot of weird people, and strange stuff happened there. And I left as soon as I could. Got a nice place in Howland with my drafting table and began to be a cartoonist more seriously. Do you want to see some different pictures? Are you bored of these ones? Anywho, I quit my job in the darkroom, got my tax return money back, and I gave myself 6 months to become some kind of cartoonist. And that would, you know, sustain me. So that was the spring of 77, and my routine really was just sitting on my nice little sunny balcony with my sketchbook and just doodling, and, you know, out of that came Reed Fleming.
Right.
And it was, it just happenstance. The name was the bad boy in my kindergarten class was called Reed Fleming. And I just stuck that name on this obstreperous character, and I think the actual real Reed Fleming has become an Anglican minister since those days. He's not that bad little boy anymore, but he's never contacted me directly, but I've heard that he's out there, and luckily he's not litigious and hasn't wanted to sue me for using his name.
Sure. Now, you know, some cartoonists regret sometimes, you know, when you have a character as long as you've had a character, that they kind of have the character that they came up with when they were very young cartoonists. I mean, do you enjoy drawing Reed? Is it still, like, fun for you? Do you like the design?
Well, Reed's tough. I mean, he's got a very difficult face to draw with that big square nose.
Right.
Like, some angles it's not hard, but other angles you really have to work to get the nose to fit on there without obscuring the nose and the mouth and the rest of it. But more than that, the personality of Reed Fleming is tough to deal with after a time. I have to get away from him because, you know, I'm not like that. He's not my alter ego.
Right.
And working on a book for a long time, I find I just have to leave him right behind and do something completely different, because it's he's not a nice guy, right?
But sure.
In a way he's amusing, but you wouldn't want to know a real life Reed Fleming. Perhaps he'd probably be in jail, you know.
I think it's kind of remarkable that you've been able to put him front and center, and it's not sometimes a character like that. Well, certainly in Heartbreak Comics, the comic book, he kind of serves as a supporting character or a second lead.
Yeah,
I mean, he might almost work better that way, or you might be able to you know, not have that reaction to him. I mean, it seems remarkable that you've been able to put him in the lead. Did you ever regret kind of having this kind of forceful character right out there in front that you might have?
Well, he wasn't the first comic I did. The first
sure.
strip was Heartbreak Comics
sure, sure.
with Laszlo. And I'd already done Reed Fleming in my sketchbook, but I never thought. Well, after a while I did. I thought there was something there. And when I first came to Vancouver, I actually tried to do a page of Reed Fleming, but it didn't work, and I knew I wasn't quite good enough to pull off what was inherent to the strip, you know, a certain attitude and a style, which I, you know, I really wasn't good enough yet to pull it off. But the impetus to try it came out of, again, nice weather and my personal life. I was doing this strip about a lover who's working at night in dark clothing. It was a lot of work, a lot of hatching, and as the weather became nicer, I didn't want to spend a lot of time, you know, obviously, doing this. Plus, I'd met the woman who became my wife, and suddenly the theme of, you know, unrequited love was a little less relevant to me.
Sure.
And also, if I could do the page faster, I could spend more time with her. So I had this milkman instead of a, you know, a dark tuxedo. He wore white. His truck is white. He works in the daytime. So a lot less drawing. It's basically just white with a few lines here and there. But obviously, it's not the drawing, it's the character that really counts. And I did the first page that I'd had in my sketchbook, you know, over again better, and put it in there as a one-shot. And it was only going to be a one-shot. So I thought, the whole character is encapsulated in this page, and there's nothing more to it.
Sure.
But to my surprise, people really responded, and they kept saying, you got to do more of these. And I kind of said, well, you know, there's nothing there to do. This, you know, it's a one-shot. This whole personality is in that page. But the capper was getting a letter from a group of guys who worked in the shipping department at Woodward's. And they drew a comic strip showing Reed Fleming bursting into the Georgia Street offices, ha-ha, and taking Laszlo, throwing him out the window, and then threatening me, in cartoon form, that if I didn't do more strips with him, you know, I get in big trouble. So I was so charmed by their creative effort that I thought, well, I better do another one and see what happens. And here I am.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned that he's not an alter ego for you. How do you think you relate to that character? Is it something, when you're writing him or working on a book with him, what appeals to you about, what appeals to you personally about him? Is it just representative of a, is he representative of a kind of humor that you like? Is it just that he's so out there that you enjoy him, or?
Well, I think, when I think about it, intellectually, because I didn't then, it was just instinctive.
Sure.
But I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and the culture to which we were exposed then, was based on older norms of what was acceptable. And that meant the bad guy always got punished. In movies and TV shows, crime never paid. The bad guy always... So that first page, Reed Fleming does all these bad things. In the first panel, he's beating a guy up. But the second panel, you see that it's because the guy made fun of his milk truck. So there's an exaggeration of response to a trivial provocation. But the whole thing is he does all these nasty things, and at the end he's threatening an old lady after dumping milk in her aquarium. He's saying, with her up against the wall, 78 cents or I piss on your flowers.
Right.
Which that was a good line. But the point is, it stopped there. And so before this payoff, this resolution, this, retribution, it just stopped. And that was the joke to me, is that he didn't get punished. He gets away with all this stuff. The end. Right? So it's like a denial of expectations. It's him, doing what he wants to do, and there's no consequence. In real life, of course, there would be a consequence to doing that
sure.
to anybody, let alone an old lady or some fish. But to me, that was the funny part, was just stopping before the resolution.
When I told people I was going to be talking to you, a lot of them threw back lines like 78 cents or I'll piss on your flowers or I get my hair cut that way
your hair cut that way or are you really bald?
I am totally bald. God started it, I finished it, is how I like to put it. You mentioned you have this really nice skill with these kind of like really powerful, funny lines. Can you talk about writing like kind of lines like that, kind of working up? Like, do you remember working up the 78 cents line? Because that's a completely bizarre but very funny line. And, of course, what's funny about it, I think, is that it's so specific. I mean, it's 78 cents.
Well, milk's more expensive now.
Right.
Like saying $1.39, or it just wouldn't work right. It's got to have a certain rhythm.
Yeah, sure.
And technically, part of it is rhythm.
Okay.
And both the writing and the visualization. You want to have a flow, and so the people get into that, and expectations are created. But I have little mottos in my head that I always make sure I pay attention to when I'm writing. One of them is thwart expectations. Now, Reed is kind of a predictable character in a way. You think you know what he's going to do, right? So you have to make sure you don't get predictable by changing it, by pulling the carpet from under the reader's feet now and then. So that's paramount, trying to keep it fresh and not repetitive. Some lines repeat well, but, you don't want to get so people are going to say, oh, I know what he's going to do next.
Sure.
So the writing part, that's mysterious. Like, where do ideas come from? If I knew, I'd make $1 million. And all you can really do is create the conditions for ideas to come. Right? So that means, cutting out stress and whatever you want to do, to create that space where you can attract ideas. And after that, it's just hard work developing it so that it's, funny. As I say, it's got rhythm. To me, it's very musical. When I write, there's got to be a pace. And when I do a book, I make sure that the bottom right-hand panel, the last panel, is a strong one. So you want to turn the page, right?
Sure.
So I always lay out the panels in the story so that when you get to that page turner, it's a strong panel. Anyway, that's just...
Very early on, and kind of this, your basic format is you go, as I recall, it's a four tiers and three panels. It's a grid at first, and then you do kind of break it up, but you have that same structure through most of your comics. And it's a very, that's a lot of beats on a page. As opposed to a lot of cartoonists that are like prone to, one single pages or a double page here. I mean, do you think the writing background that you have, that you want so much going on, because your stories are very involved as a result, a short story by you, 8 pages by you seems like, 16 pages by a cartoonist that kind of is dealing in more, bigger panels and kind of those kind of broader moments. Do you like that kind of intensive story per page, that engrossing experience that you kind of get out of your work? Is that?
Well, I think it's important that when you go back to the comic, there's something there to find out and to discover the second time or the third time. So I try and have maybe a subtext. Again, a musical response is like counterpoint. Other stuff going on below the main theme, so that when you go back to it, there's stuff to discover. But at the beginning, it was like a self-imposed limitation, that 12 panels per page. Do you remember SCTV?
Sure.
And a character played by John Candy, Johnny LaRue?
Sure.
Anybody remember that? He had a show called Street Beef. You know, it took Man in the Street. One camera, one microphone, one interviewer, right? So with the comic, it's the same thing. I used one pen and 12 same-size panels deliberately as a limitation so that, you know, I wouldn't have too much to think about. And in a way, limitations force you to be, you know, inventive,
sure,
to overcome those limitations. And as I got better, you know, I used more pens and different layouts. Like Heartbreak, I used, I think, 5 or 6 pens and 2 or 3 brushes.
Okay.
Like the 000 brushes with white paint and things like that. But initially, Reed Fleming, a single pen for everything, you know, shading, outlining, and lettering. And that made my job a bit simpler. I didn't have to think about what do I do now, because too many choices can just confuse you.
Right.
Or the reader.
You mentioned Heartbreak. Heartbreak is a very attractive comic. It's a very lovely-looking comic. And certainly there are elements. It's not like there aren't those elements in Reed Fleming from that, even from that same period or right after, where it's not, there's no drop in accomplishment of the art. But there's a very specific look. I mean, was it just that you just wanted to, you wanted a comic that moved quickly, more quickly in the process of it, that the Reed stuff is different? Or what made, I mean, what were you thinking in terms of Heartbreak that made it such a involved, pretty comic? What made you want to do that kind of comic?
The character was inspired by a certain type you see in old movies, 30s movies, the comic European gigolo. And that type has pretty much died out in the cinema. But back then, it was a comic stereotype. So in a way, it was like thinking, what would that guy do if he was living today? You know, he's trying to impress women by dressing well and being elegant and continental. So to go with that character, the look is supposed to reflect the time in which he existed. So there's a sort of a variance with the world of today in that kind of look. I wanted it to look like a 1934 Paramount movie, you know, that kind of black and white. And it took some doing to get that good. I wasn't, you know, very good when I started, so it took a while to get to the point where I could make it look the way I wanted to. But as Reed Fleming looked kind of scratchy, and part of the reason it looked scratchy is I did those first pages in my sketchbook with this pretty rough paper, and I would just do this strip and then cut it out and hand it in. And the scratchiness, I think, suited the character. It shouldn't look too refined and elegant. Whereas with Heartbreak comics, the smoothness and opulence of the look is sort of what Laszlo would think about himself. He wanted to see himself in that kind of a world. And so the look should reflect the character's own, you know, milieu.
Sure. Well, I mean, similarly with when you did Rogue to Riches, the storyline was in Reed Fleming. Mm-hmm. Was there a similar thought in your mind to do something more ambitious, or did that kind of organically develop on the page? That's 135 pages or so of story, and very kind of layered and ambitious. It really works in that kind of terms, but it's not something that I really even considered in those terms until, you know, you mentioned in your recent material that you kind of considered it, that, you know, you wanted your attempt, your kind of graphic novel starring Reed, with maybe one to come. But was that kind of, did that develop organically? Did you just end up with a story that was that long, or did you decide that you were going to do a kind of more ambitious Reed story?
Long story short, I did the first book in 1980. I self-published this book.
Sure.
And I was fortunate in that Last Gasp, a distributor in San Francisco, picked it up. I did it in Vancouver and tried to sell it locally, and it was doing okay, but obviously, you know, I had 10,000 books, and I just picked a number out of the thin air, which was kind of stupid, you know, 10,000 copies. But, you know, I was sitting there with all these books, and I got to sell these somehow. So a friend was going to San Francisco. He dropped in to see Ron Turner, who runs Last Gasp,
sure,
to this day. He looked at the book,
And he said, I'll take 500 copies. And a month later, 2,000.
Wow.
And I broke even in less than 6 months, and the rest was profit, so I thought, not bad. That first book's been through 6-7 printings now. Never been out of print. But then in 1986, at a convention in Victoria, B.C., I was approached by Eclipse Comics,
sure,
now defunct. And the woman who ran it, or co-ran it, Kat Ironwood,
yeah. She
told me that she had this idea I was some kind of a rich guy who just did comics sort of as a sideline and otherwise didn't, you know, do anything. I don't know why she thought that. But they offered me a contract to do more. So suddenly I had to fulfill the terms of the contract and turn out books. So it's like, what do I do now?
Okay.
So I just started with some stuff I had. I had a number of scenes written and little bits and pieces over the years. I keep pretty extensive notebooks, and I never waste anything. The stuff I'm doing in the current Reed Fleming graphic novel that I wrote in 1985.
Wow. Okay.
Like big scenes. I knew someday I'm going to use this. You big chunks, right? I don't know how, but I'm going to work it in someday to what I do. So it was basically necessity. Like, how do I do a book? How do I do another book and keep it going? And with that first graphic novel, I was making it up as I went along. When I got to that last chapter, I was really stuck. It was like, how do I finish this? I'm really in a corner. And it took a whole lot of thinking to get out of that corner. But I used the old plot trope of the surprise father, right?
Right.
And that's been used in a lot of movies and novels. Like Scaramouche, for instance, uses that plot device. And in this case, the president of Milk Incorporated turns out to have been a milkman who generated Reed Fleming with one of his customers years ago. And he just discovers this at the very end. But it all worked, and I had people actually saying I was surprised you were able to finish it because I thought it was just going to go off into space. But if you read, I think it's pretty cohesive.
Yeah,
now, the one I'm doing now, I do know the ending. I know the exact ending, and I'm just filling in the blank to get there. And I've got that about 65-70% done.
Wow.
So I've done the first three chapters. It's five chapters. I'm just, you know, trying to get the rest of it done for the second volume of the collected Reed Fleming. The first, of course, is out now. You can see it.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it. IDW did a big, beautiful, yellow hardcover reprint.
I saw a copy on the way in.
Reprint of the Reed Fleming, of the classic Reed Fleming material. That's a terrific book. What was it like to get that material back together again? First of all, did you have negatives? Because I know that some people didn't have negatives from the Eclipse days. Was there any problem getting the material together?
Well, I had the negatives for all my books shot in Vancouver by a very professional guy named Bill Cole. He's dead now, but he knew his stuff.
Okay.
And he was the best guy. He was recommended by Rand Holmes, another cartoonist I
knew. Sure.
He shot all my negatives, and I made sure I got them back. But with Eclipse, they did various printings, and then their business began to kind of go downhill. And I found out later they had all the negatives in their original layout sheets on big wooden shelves that later collapsed. Everything went, and instead of picking them up, the workers just walked on them. Kat Ironwood told me this later. And also, this building in which the negatives were housed twice survived near floods.
Yeah,
it was on a hill. Water came up and almost engulfed the building. I got the negatives back with great difficulty when they finally went bankrupt. When I got them back, they were scratched. There were footprints on them. Some were okay, but I had to do a lot of reshooting. And to answer your real question, with this book, although I had the negatives, they were at the printer from my own printing, and I had a bit of a printer's bill I couldn't pay. So I couldn't use those negatives at all. My dirty little secret is this book was all done from scans. I did myself. I was out of good copies, right?
Well, it looks nice. I would not have guessed that at all.
It was scary because, you know, it's like, if this doesn't work, I'm, you know?
Right, right.
But I think I pulled it off.
What was it like? I mean, what was it like to like, look at the material? I know with a lot of cartoonists, like looking at old material kind of
horrible
forces them to reconsider it.
I should be a pizza driver again. Well, you're confronted with all your mistakes and all the things you wish you could do over again.
Sure.
When I do a book, it's dead. I never look at it again unless I have to.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm not really a comics guy. Other things are more attractive. So especially with this first book, when I was forced to, you know, prepare it for publication, I was confronted with the awfulness of the lettering, for instance. And back then, the first book anyway, the lettering was the thing I didn't care about. I just wanted to get it over with. So it's not great. And looking at it again, I thought, man, that just isn't good enough. So I spent a lot of time on the computer touching up the lettering in that first book to make it more legible. Because the first thing is clarity. The reader's got to be able to follow things without going, oh, where do I go next? You know, I'm really careful to make things flow. So I worked hard to make that first book more legible. The rest I left alone. Like, I don't believe in going back and redrawing things and changing them. You know, just leave it the way it is. It's a document, for better or worse.
Sure.
But the temptation is always like, how could I let that hand pass? I could do way better today, you know? But if you start doing that, you'll never finish.
Sure, sure.
And so I just let everything stand the way it was and bit my tongue, and there it is.
Now, your IDW did the reprints, and they're a media company, and they're focused on some getting some of their properties made into film. You wrote a very good script of Reed Fleming. The script I read was your script, am
yeah.
I right? Yeah, and it very, very good, very entertaining script. One of the few I think I've ever read where the creator actually, you know, did the script. I mean, is that something that still interests you with that character? Is this kind of publishing initiative done with that in mind?
I deliberately drew the first book to appeal to movie makers.
Huh.
And part of it is that having the panels the same size, it's like a storyboard. And you could take it and shoot it pretty much as it is. Well, a lot of it, anyhow. The movie, that's a long story.
Sure,
I'll give you the short version, but the script you read is about 80% pure. Like, my two producers, one of whom was Jeff Loeb, and he's a well-known comics writer today DC. He and his partner had just had a big hit called Teen Wolf in the mid-80s. They initially contacted me right after the book came out. They were still in university in Boston, I think. And they were just getting started, and they tried to get an option off me for $150. Which, you know, I thought, come on. And then I had some experiences with Dave Thomas from SCTV.
Sure.
He wanted to play Reed Fleming. And it almost happened at MGM after their first film, Strange Brew. The film didn't do great, but I just came across some old notes. Everybody wanted to make the film except the two top guys at MGM. But in a way, I'm glad they didn't do it then, because it was not my script.
Okay.
They would have used, and the script that was written, I thought was kind of
right.
Really didn't have the character at all. Anyway, that's a big other story. Years later, it wound up at Warner Brothers, and for them, I wrote the script that exists today, and it's been through countless actors and would-be producers. Lots of people would like to make it into a film. The studio will not sell it.
Right.
Period. They don't seem to want to make it either.
Wasn't there a reading at one point with...
Yes,
with,
there is. And if I could find... I got a picture here of this poster that was signed. The actor John Lovitz. Anybody know him?
Right.
He pushed for years to make that. Before him, Jim Belushi. He pushed very hard to be Reed Fleming. And his film career never really took off.
Sure.
Since then, many actors have wanted to play the part. I get letters all the time from different people. I could give you a list, but it's kind of pointless. But where was I? This project has been stuck there forever. You see, movies are not made because studios want to make good movies. They want a vehicle for their talent.
Sure.
And the problem is, there's not really any actor who can, I think, embody the part today. There might be somebody out there I know, but I just don't know.
Sure.
But back then, there was a guy I thought would have been great, Bob Hoskins. Like, if I could have got him in 1980,
oh, yeah.
Or whenever, 85, 86, when I was doing the script, I would have been so happy. Because he's a guy who can act with his eyes.
Yeah.
He's got that intensity and humor as well. And he was considered at the time, this is 1987 now that I'm talking about, when I was working for Warner Brothers and going down there and having meetings and stuff like that. But he, at the time, wouldn't read it unless there was $1 million on the table.
Sure.
And nobody was offering that. A lot of other actors were considered. Some were just high in the sky, like I couldn't believe the names being thrown around. But same thing, it came down to the top two guys at the studio finally reading the script like a year after everybody else and saying, I don't get it.
Right. Did you see the reading that was done? The actual reading? Okay.
That was done in 1996
right. With
John Lovitz, and he got his pals together to portray the other parts. Lisa Kudrow played Lena, Ed Asner played Mr. O'Clock, and I've got a signed poster. I got a picture I could show you if I could just, later. But and then for Mr. Crab, Phil Hartman.
Wow.
And I thought he was a great actor. In fact, I wish he had played Reed Fleming, but no studio would ever back a guy like him. But he was a fantastic actor who could play any part. A really utilitarian but accomplished guy with voices as well. And had a real good cast. He did a reading for the executives there. I was not present. And it's a different folder if you open up the main one there and you can find this picture. Yeah, Hollywood. Yeah. Well, that's me getting kicked off the front lawn of Warner Brothers. There's the poster.
Okay.
So it's if you can get it bigger there somehow, but if I may. It's kind of crunchy looking here. That's John Lovitz.
Okay.
Dan Castellaneta played Cooper. He's the voice of Homer Simpson.
Yeah.
Phil Hartman. Of course, 2 years later, he was murdered in his sleep by his wife.
Sure.
Shot him in the head. Twice.
Yeah,
just to be sure.
Let me ask you before we let everybody go, because they came in and flashed me the signal.
We're out of time already.
Is there an ETA on the second book with the new material in it? Do you know when that we might see that?
Well, a rough game plan, thanks to IDW, they've tried or are trying to get me down to San Diego next year as a special guest. That means the convention pays all costs.
Sure.
Right? And that'd be lovely if they do that. It's under consideration right now. So obviously having a second book ready for then would be wonderful. And it's just getting it done in that length of time. Now, I got to say, the last chapter of this book is huge in terms of what goes on, the events. There's going to be a competition between the dairies, the milkman games. It's like a combination Olympics and Miss America beauty pageant, because there's a swimsuit competition in addition to three-legged races and stuff like that. But it entails a big event with many characters, some new characters as well, no spoilers, but big sets. Now, I don't have anybody helping. I do my own backgrounds, unlike some cartoonists. So it's pretty time-consuming. And I've got other things in my life besides comics,
Sure.
My kids have all left home. My wife works out of the home. And so I do, housework. She comes home, there's a clean kitchen and all that stuff. But it's not time-consuming, but, I work out of my own home. And I got to work around other stuff. I'm also a photographer, and
sure.
I mow the lawn, and I do all kinds of things.
Let me ask you, you're going to talk to Seth tonight and receive the honor that you're more than due, and that's going to be a wonderful thing. But are you also here at the show? Are you set up anywhere?
I'm doing signings. One at 10, 11 o'clock. I'm doing two today and two tomorrow.
Okay.
All 90 minutes. And I'm going to have stuff, not too much, but I got some T-shirts, and I'll sign stuff, and, like your cast or your sketchbook or whatever. And any questions? I mean, there's a lot more I could talk about, but
I can totally
talk personally if anybody wants to query me further.
Yeah, I wanted to say that because I totally dominated your time with not keeping track of the time to get people's questions from the audience. Thank you so much for coming out today and help me thank David.